There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question, were you high on drugs?
Last question, kiss my
This is Jeff Moore filling in for Sean Sullivan today on Midday Mobile, FM Talk 106.5, turning up your voice. Give us a call or send us a text at 251-343-0106. A lot to get to today. Obviously, the big news in the news cycle today is the hurricane. I think there's no question about that. There's a, you turn on any channel right now, we're talking hurricane. But I want to kind of switch gears and talk a little bit about politics. Last night, there was an election in New York State. We had Andrew Cuomo, who's the incumbent governor of New York, and unidentified, I mean, you know, unquestionably very, 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 very liberal. But he had a challenger to his left, Cynthia Nixon, I think probably best identified as from her Sex and the City stardom. She ran a campaign to the left of Andrew Cuomo last night, and that was kind of the news. Cuomo obviously beat her by 30-something points, but I think what we, you know, the big takeaway from last night in New York State is there were some other things going on. There were some down-ballot races, I think, that are kind of a precursor to where the enthusiasm is in the Democratic Party, at least in certain parts of the country. But kind of talking big picture midterm elections here, and just was talking to a pollster a few minutes ago about the trend he's looking at right now. And his name is John Cuvion, and he comes out of Louisiana. But he is explaining to me that, like, if you look at these down-ballot races, a lot of moderate Republicans lost last night. We have some enthusiasm on the very far length in the Democratic Party, and it's his conclusion that this is kind of translating to what's going on everywhere outside of Alabama, and we're going to see a big night for Democrats, you know, not just historically, as is the case when the party in power has a midterm election and then they lose big. That's just been the trend every year, I believe, the exception of 2002, right after 9/11. But the idea is he's seeing enthusiasm from Democrats that is matching the 2006 midterm election. Now, if we flash back to 2006, think about this. It's unpopular George W. Bush, Katrina. We're coming out of the throes of Hurricane Katrina and all the negative press and all the heat Bush took for that. And then we're also, you know, we're looking at a very, very unpopular Iraq war. With the Iraq war and the unpopularity of the Iraq war, it didn't lend itself well for Republicans. Republicans really, they were knowing, they saw the loss coming. So, you know, in this midterm, to me, it's starting, you know, obviously the month of September is always bad historically for Republicans. I think the polls will tighten, but at this point in time right now, I think we're looking at a big night for Democrats outside the state of Alabama. We're going to talk about the state of Alabama itself in a few minutes, about some of the stuff with KIV and Walt Maddox, and if there's anything for us to really be interested in. But big term national speaking, if you're a Republican out there, you hear some Republicans saying that, well, Democrats, they don't come out for midterms. This happened in 2010. This happened in 2014. Democrats lost the House in 2010. Democrats lost the Senate later in 2014, but they still won the presidency with Obama. And that's just a product. That's just the nature of voters. They, you know, your more liberal voters, they stay home on They stay home on midterms because they just midterms don't capture quite the imagination that the presidential election cycle does. It's on every channel. It's Rock the Vote MTV. It's in all these places. Obama was doing appearances on ESPN and all these different, you know, kind of pop culture-y out of the mainstream news cycle. And we know about it. And that's what draws your traditional Democratic voter. But getting back to that, this is a little different. There's, you know, it's easy to discount what the mainstream media is saying about Donald Trump. They're obviously critics of him, but they seem to have ignited at least a little bit of a spark. And I think we're kind of head downhill with regards to that. I think that Democrats, the enthusiasm on their side, and it's not just my previous theory was it was just in New York, it was just in California, it was just in Oregon, it was just in Washington, all these places that traditionally go Democrat. They hated Trump the first time, they really hate Trump now, so they're really going to come out in these places. But where it counted, Michigan or, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio, you get in some of the Rust Belt states, and you get to the away from the coastal elites, and you get into the blue collar territories, you get into the flyover country, the enthusiasm wasn't quite there. Certainly, historically, is probably the uphill battle Donald Trump was going to face. But that's, you know, if you base it on some of the primary and the turnout for Democrats in primaries compared to Republicans, it's going to be a really rough road for Republicans. I'm starting to think it's going to be a little tough for Republicans in some places outside the South. Now, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of things going on in the South that I think are a total separate discussion. But if we're just going to talk straight up midterms, guys, buckle up. It's going to be tough. Democrats, they really got a lot of they got this enthusiasm thing going, and I think it kind of bleeds out of the coastal areas and going into the mid part of the country. But the idea is, you know, I was talking to another former Democratic congressman yesterday, and he was explaining to me, like, look, it's going to be rough, but right now is the roughest part. He thinks Democrats are always poll well in September. You're coming out of August. August has traditionally been a bad month for politics for the party in power, and they're riding kind of a rough summer into September. And they're heading to, you know, this is when the general election campaigns really starting to heat up. We're done with the primaries. We're running advertisements that are focused more on big picture stuff and not like who could be the Trumpiest of the Trump candidates, or in this case, who could be the anti-Trumpiest of the anti-Trump candidates. Now you could really make your message about why I'm the guy that's going to either be the Trump guy or I'm going to be the anti-Trump guy. And from Maine to California, Washington State to Florida, it's kind of trending toward anti-Trump. And people, you know, for better or for worse, the Russia stuff started to get to him a little, I think, in the polling. I think there's some other things going on now that these indictments are being read and these plea deals are being given. And, you know, you even had a conviction with Manafort a couple of weeks ago. You have all these things that are just starting to weigh down on Trump. And then you add to that the bombshells, this New York Times op-ed, just feeding fuel to the fire. And you look at the you look at this Woodward book. All that stuff is kind of secondary, and it's starting to kind of erode where Trump has really made his grab, which is the economy. And what I would say is I think if I'm, you know, and obviously I don't think the Trump campaign is necessarily listening to Mobile Radio, but if they were, I would say you need to get on your message would be, are you better off now than you were 2 years ago? So start thinking in those terms. And if you're a local Republican, that's the way you got to start treating this. This is Democrats. We were for 8 years, things kind of stayed at the status quo. They kind of stayed at an equilibrium. And then the economy started to turn around right after the 2016 election. And that got us on a better playing field with the economy. So it's got to be economy, 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 economy. And all these distractions and all this stuff is starting to eat away at the bigger message that my economic policies are working. You know, tariffs, while they're not, you know, the most favored by many on the Republican side, they are starting to get a lot of these bad players to the table and getting them to talk a little bit about, you know, maybe we need to make better trade deals and think about things like that. But what I would say is just if they could get back to that point where they're talking about the economy and we can put some of these distractions away and we make it through hurricane season, maybe the Republicans can kind of weather some of this storm and things will look a little bit better heading into the midterm election. This is Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan today on FM Talk 106.5.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And it's Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan today on Midday Mobile, turning up your voice. Give us a call or send a text, 251-343-0106. As usual, I'm joined by Dalton Orwig.
Yes,
just I'm manning the board and kind of holding phones. My hand through this ordeal.
And I'm manning the phones today. And not holding your hand at all. You got this.
It's a one-man it's like a one-man show over here, one-and-a-half-man show over here, right?
That's right. So if you do call in, I'm going to put you on hold. Please hold on for us because that's how we're taking calls today. Just to let you know, 343-0106.
It'd be great if you could host a show.
Screen phone calls and run the board.
And just do it all at once.
Yeah.
And then you get like a scout's badge or something. Uh-huh. You know,
some
you
kind of patch. Yeah, something like that.
Even like one of those apps or something that says you just won this badge. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, you did a good job. That's all I'm looking for. I get it a lot around here that I've done a good job. So, but yeah, if you are calling in, I'll put you on hold. Don't be freaked out when you hear the radio station playing.
And you hear my voice.
That's right.
That would be enough to freak people out in general. Getting back to what we were talking about last hour, kind of what to expect in the midterms. We were, I was talking about what I think was going to happen nationally. Here locally, the races have not been, as compelling. I think, that's to be expected. All the excitement and enthusiasm tends to be in the primaries. Who's going to be the Republican nominee? And you have a kind of a scrum. Who can get, in this cycle, it was who could be the Trumpiest. And, for better or for worse, I don't know if that was the best way to go about running in a Republican primary in Alabama. I think maybe there is a little bit of lazy consulting going on saying, well, you don't really have a message, but you can always talk about Trump. And those guys in Alabama, they just love their Alabama football. They love their Donald Trump. So if you can work any of that in, then you're going to be the Republican nominee. And then we saw sort of this, I don't know, it was kind of the appeal to the lowest common denominator in some instances with just who could be the most Trump. And that, we could go back to the 2017 cycle and talk about that too and how that, didn't necessarily work even with Trump in Alabama campaigning for Luther Strange, who was the official Trump candidate, didn't win. But yeah, we went with that. And that was where all the money was spent. That's where all the excitement is. So fast forward, here we are. We're in we're hitting midpoint of September. This is really the kind of a slower time in the election cycle in Alabama just because all the excitement's over with. But you still got to go vote and you still got to go through the formality of the general election. And given that Doug Jones, a Democrat, won in 2017, is it possible for a Democrat to reproduce that success, replicate that success, and we could have, a governor of Alabama that's a Democrat or a congressman from somewhere? Maybe there's a state Senate seat or a state House seat or something here that they could just build off of and show some kind of, moral victory here, if anything. I think the moral victory for them, for Democrats, came when they were able to actually fill a ballot with candidates. That, there were people that were willing to run against Martha Roby. There were people willing to run against Bradley Byrne. There were people willing to run. You just go down the list. The ballot was full. Democrats were qualified for the race. They paid their qualifying fee, and they were participating in the process. So baby steps. Well, here we are in the election, and you look around the state and just talking to people, none of these races are particularly compelling as far as being competitive. There's some antics and stuff we could talk about that in a little bit. In Alabama's 3rd Congressional District, you have a former Miss America running, and she's kind of got an interesting story. But if we're just looking at the straight-up tactics of the situation and if any of these races could be competitive, there's not really one on the map. I say maybe the closest one you could see is the Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice race. It's Tom Parker, who has not raised hardly any money and he's kind of got some ties to Roy Moore that some people think would be a vulnerability, up against Bob Vance, the son of a former federal judge, married to Joyce Vance of MSNBC fame, who's kind of kooky and wears a tinfoil hat, goes on and talks about Russia all the time. But he's raising a lot of money. He's doing the things he's got to do to get out. And he's totally separate from his wife. He's like the all shucks country boy, sort of the Doug Jones that we see kind of talking about, as far as you could talk about a judicial race and make it interesting, but how he's looking at taking care and protecting the people's interest and not letting, companies come into Alabama take advantage of us, and all these things you would kind of think of if you're running for Supreme Court that you would talk about. That might be the closest race, but I still think Tom Parker probably wins that race, not by 7-8 points. He's not really doing a whole lot out there to really separate himself. He's not raising money. He's doing appearances here and there, but he's not on the ground like the other candidates running for statewide office. Just last night, I was in Butler, Alabama, in Choctaw County. Kay Ivey, she won't debate, but to her credit, she is kind of all over the map. When I say all over the map, she's going to different places, doing the ribbon cuttings, and showing her face in public. It's not as if she's hiding out in the governor's mansion. And, the knock on her as well, what is she doing? Why won't she debate Walt Maddox? And we could argue whether or not they should debate. I don't know. I'm not sure that any election in Alabama has ever been decided by what happens on the debate stage. I think that's just Walt Maddox trying to get a situation where he can stand next to Kay Ivey, show that he's a kind of a fit guy, a young guy, a fresh face, and she's an older lady, and maybe they want to try the route that failed for the Republican challengers in the primary, she's going to have health problems down the road or something like that. There's these whisper campaigns. You've heard them all. But I think that's the strategy there. I don't know that works. I think it's a risky, even if you got her on the debate stage and you thought you could confront her, why would you want to be the guy that's picking on Grandma? Why do you want to be, messing with Meemaw? And all of a sudden he looks like a bad guy instead of the young, fresh face. But they continue to pursue this line. They continue to pursue that. And who out there is going to be swayed one way or another by KIV's refusal to debate Walt Maddox? I think the people that are really sounding that alarm right now, we're going to vote for Walt Maddox in the first place. And it tends to be Democrat activists and our friends in the sort of mainstream media in Alabama, the newspapers, the Montgomery Advertiser, AL.com, obviously. Some of the TV stations, it is an institutional bias. There's media bias everywhere. It's just in Alabama, it may not be as pronounced as it is, as you see on your cable channels. But I do think there's a lot of what's driving this train about a Walt Maddox-KIV debate is coming out of the media. But that being said, one thing I want to talk about, I would say if I were to critique the Democrats right now and what they could do better, they're using the same playbook they used when Jim Folsom Jr. ran for lieutenant governor in 2006. I think maybe the Parker Griffin playbook when he ran for governor against Bentley. It's the Ron Sparks playbook. It's the same people in these campaigns every cycle that are kind of fixtures in the Walt Maddox cycle. In Walt Maddox campaign. And in addition to that, Walt Maddox was doing public appearances with Don Siegelman. Who is going to go out and vote for Walt Maddox because of Don Siegelman? So he's marrying himself to the old Democratic Party of Alabama. And what's the definition of insanity? Trying the same thing and expecting a different result. They're trying the same thing they've been trying for the last 20, 30 years, guys. And it's not going to produce the same result. I think if you look at some of the polls, maybe some of the internal polls from the Maddox campaign I've heard about have it within 10 points. But in my imagination, I got to think it's probably more like 15, 20 points. Some of the other polls that the Ivy campaign has released, it's been even in the 30s. Just some absurd numbers out there. If I'm Walt Maddox, I'm not going to run this campaign against Kay Ivey. I'm going to run it against the status quo. I'm going to stop messing with her health. I'm going to stop talking about debates. I'm going to stop all these hashtag believes and all these like airy fairy pie in the sky kind of things. Here's what I'm going to do. The same old Democratic thing about the lottery. If you want to go with the lottery, that's fine. but maybe along the interstates, maybe along I-10 on the way to Florida or on the way to Miss, or you know, wherever you go to buy your lottery tickets, I'll put up a sign. Are you tired of driving to Florida to go buy a Powerball ticket? Vote for me. How about doing that? How about this? You know, you're getting into the Wallace Tunnel over there on I-10, and you're sitting in traffic, and you're just fed up. All you want to do is get home. How about another billboard? You tired of sitting in traffic? Vote for me. I'm not the same old Alabama Department of Transportation. I'm going to do things different. There's been a real reluctance, and I question why the Republicans that were running against Ivy in the primary didn't try this. Why didn't they say, we're going to run her against the status quo? We're going to set up to where we want to make it. Just people have certain expectations for state government, government in general. They just want their trash picked up, their mail delivered. They just want government to do these set things. I think getting back and forth at home to work, that's one of the biggest things people ask for from their government. And that's where you go up against the incumbent. That's where you go up against the status quo. That's how you win an election. Just kind of a refusal to do that. We talked about a lot of other things. But that being said, that's the direction I would go. This is Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Give us a call. Let us know what you think. 251-343-0106.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
And it's Jeff Poor filling in for Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Turning up your voice, give us a call or send us a text, 251-343-0106. I want to bring on a guest, kind of a guy that he's got a book out talking about how corruption is really kind of, money in politics has found its way into our law enforcement on the federal level, and corruption, you know, whenever that happens, it's just ripe for corruption. There's all these possibilities. But I have a Seamus Bruner on the line from the Government Accountability Institute. He's got a book out called Compromised, How Money and Politics Drive FBI Corruption. Thanks for joining the show, Seamus.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, so we'll just kick it off here. Just tell us a little bit about the book and kind of the premise of it and what you're trying to accomplish with, you know, with sitting down and writing this book.
Yeah, so everybody really knows about the politics and the bias at the FBI during the 2016 election and campaign. What a lot of people aren't talking about is the amount of money that a lot of these players have made off of their public service. Everybody knows kind of James Comey, Robert Mueller, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page. But at the Government Accountability Institute, we followed the money, and we followed it to the top of the FBI and DOJ. And what we found is these guys are no better than any other of the swamp creatures who cash in on their public service, turn their public service into self-service. So we found particularly James Comey and Robert Mueller have made a lot of money, many millions, over $10 million for James Comey in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, and you actually sat down and kind of calculated. There's some astronomical sort of figures here when you were talking about how much Comey increased his wealth just coming out of you know, he spent some time out of the FBI in 2005, I think, or left the DOJ in 2005, and he says net worth went up 4,000%.
Yeah, that's right. We calculated it using the personal financial disclosures that these people have to submit to Congress. So for James Comey, here are the facts. In 2003, he submitted a document showing that he was worth just $206,000. That's a very modest net worth for a public servant. He had a mortgage, you know, he had debt and some assets. Well, he leaves the Department of Justice. This is before he joins the FBI. He leaves the Department of Justice in 2005, hovering right around $200,000. And in 5 years, he had made over $10 million at the largest contractor, really, in American history. This is Lockheed Martin. And he wasn't just a consultant or an advisor. He was the general counsel at Lockheed Martin. And so, you know, by the time he returns to run the FBI in 2013, like you said, his net worth had shot up over 4,000%. Most Americans can't even fathom what that looks like. But it's many millions of dollars. It's $6.1 million in a single year. That's 2009. So it really begs the question, how did he do it? And what we found is the FBI, under Robert Mueller, a longtime associate and pal of James Comey, started giving multiple $100 million contracts to Lockheed Martin, including a $1 billion contract while James Comey was there.
Yeah, just to kind of catch the listeners up here, James Comey, of course, is the former FBI director, served under Obama, was fired by Trump, and really was kind of the impetus for this Mueller probe, I'll bet you think, because, you know, it led to many suggest there could have been some kind of, you know, obstruction of justice or something along those lines. But anyway, when you talk about this relationship between Comey and Mueller, who's now heading up this probe, you know, it goes back several years. It goes back a while, right?
That's right. A lot of the players in this story, another guy, Rod Rosenstein, Rod Rosenstein started working for Robert Mueller in the criminal division in 1990. I mean, that's almost 30 years ago. But James Comey and Robert Mueller have worked together since the late 90s at the Department of Justice and FBI. That's almost 20 years. And so they go back a long way, and they have worked closely together. There's an incident I talk about in the book. In 2004, they kind of led the charge against the Bush administration's terrorist surveillance program. And the media depiction of these men has been just totally skewed. They're painted as these sort of choir boys or Boy Scouts.
Right, just like public integrity guys, like really, like, yeah, like you said, Boy Scouts standing up for true justice in the American way. That's sort of the picture we've gotten from these guys.
Right, and we've now obviously learned that portrait is a sham. This incident in 2004 where Robert Mueller was James Comey's backup, they kind of pressured the Bush administration to scrap this terrorist surveillance program, and it was all reported as, wow, they're just standing up for the American people and their right to privacy. But we, of course, know that that's not the case. Under Robert Mueller and James Comey, they built one of the most intrusive surveillance apparatuses ever known. I mean, probably the most intrusive surveillance apparatus ever known. And now we have learned that it's been used to spy against innocent civilians, even journalists. And now, the most shocking of all, is a presidential candidate.
Well, tell me this: when Lockheed Martin hires somebody like a James Comey, what are they getting for their dollar? Like when we hear Comey made $6.1 million, what are the expectations for that salary? That's kind of my curiosity.
Well, if you use the annual reports, we went through all of Lockheed Martin's annual reports. They cite specifically he resolved litigation against the company successfully, and there's thousands of lawsuits against Lockheed Martin, so it could be anything from a civil suit to possible criminal suit. But it certainly would help having the contacts that James Comey had over at the FBI, like Robert Mueller and his former associates at the DOJ. That would have been Rod Rosenstein was at the DOJ. So these players have kind of worked together, like I said, since the 90s. They know the right avenues to navigate. I mean, it sort of makes sense in a way why you would hire a James Comey, although something kind of shocking about James Comey, he had never led the general counsel's office of such a large corporation, so he was sort of a relative novice to the private sector side. And you cited the figure 6.1. That's just a single year that James Comey made $6.1 million. They don't disclose how much he made in the years 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008, but we really only know exactly how much he made in 2009. But if you extrapolate it further, I mean, it could be anywhere upwards of $30 million for a short 5-year span.
Well,
additionally, the security clearance issue, President Trump revoked John Brennan's security clearance, and you see this huge uproar from people like James Comey and Robert Mueller and John Brennan, you know, these former intelligence guys. That's one of the other reasons why Lockheed Martin would pay him so much money, is he gets to keep his security clearance.
Yeah, but it just seems to me there's more to it than his legal expertise. While he was kind of a high-ranking Department of Justice guy, Southern District of New York, and was just kind of player throughout, you know, government for the last 20, 30 years, what does he bring any sort of political expertise where, like, if I'm Lockheed Martin, I'm like, I could get this guy, I could get him on retainer, Is he able to like kind of grease the skids for, you know, maybe what they're working on in Congress or within an administration or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really great question. And what we found is they hired James Comey in 2005. In 2006, the FBI, under the direction of Robert Mueller, gives Lockheed Martin a $350 million contract called Sentinel. It's the Sentinel program. And that was really revolutionizing the FBI's IT infrastructure. And then in 2008, under the direction of Robert Mueller, the FBI grants Lockheed Martin a $1 billion program called Next Generation Identification. And a lot of people think of Lockheed Martin as this jet manufacturer. Well, one of their largest divisions, the largest revenue stream, is their IT division, which is specifically surveillance technology. So this $1 billion contract, Next Generation Identification, was first of all protested by one of the other bidders. So there's something shady with the, you know, way it was awarded by the FBI to Lockheed Martin. But also, it's been called a boondoggle, primarily because of cost overruns and delays for Lockheed Martin. So it actually grew to over $1 billion award to Lockheed Martin. But yeah, exactly like you asked, James Comey certainly would know how to grease the skids with his former colleagues, and would also know how to legally implement some of these programs where they're legal. Authorization is somewhat shady, you know, spying on every man, woman, and child in America and creating a fingerprint for their face. It was a facial recognition program. So I think it's kind of a twofold. He would know how to legally justify these programs and make sure they're implemented, quote unquote, legally. But it's also greasing the skids and knowing, you know, the networks and the, you know, connections he had at his former job in public service.
And real quick, let's kind of wrap it up on Robert Mueller, who's leading this probe that we hear about in day in and day out every day, looking into Russian collusion in the 2016 presidential election. You say that he has some sort of like ties to the Silicon Valley and the tech world, and it may be giving him kind of a leg up on his investigation. He's able to have some things without needing a subpoena, that he has these ties, you know, with, you know, encryption and all the things that these tech firms do, and they pride themselves on them being really, really locked down with the privacy. But with Robert Mueller, he's learned some workarounds that are kind of outside the norms of protocol.
Right. So I call these guys kind of like this surveillance tag team. They work together inside and outside the government. So in 2013, James Comey, having just made 10 million plus, you know, anywhere from 10 to 30 million, really. And the reason that there's uncertainty about the total number is because of unclear disclosures. They only have to give ranges. But, you know, anywhere upwards of $30 million, James Comey comes back to the FBI, tags in, Robert Mueller tags out as FBI director. Mueller does the same thing. He heads to the private sector. He sets up a consulting outfit called Robert Mueller and Associates. He starts giving speeches, kind of like the Clintons do. That's you know, mid five figures, so not quite Clinton numbers, but yeah. So he's raking in money from speeches. He also starts taking clients through the law firm Wilmer Hale. He worked with them in the 90s, so it's a long time affiliation. And by the time Robert Mueller becomes a special counsel in May 2017, we just have one disclosure for him in this time period in the private sector, but it's from 2016 to 2017. Robert Mueller takes in over $3.5 million. And you brought up some of the Silicon Valley clients. Well, two of Robert Mueller's clients that helped make him that $3.5 million are now cooperating with the special counsel investigation. That's Apple Inc. and Facebook Inc. And Apple actually provided Mueller's investigation access to Paul Manafort's iCloud service. And a lot of people think of Apple as this kind of paragon of privacy who, you know, they refused to turn over the San Bernardino terrorist iPhone. They don't unlock that for the FBI, but they're all too willing to cooperate with their former attorney, Robert Mueller's probe. And the other, you mentioned the subpoena, Facebook Inc. is also cooperating with the Mueller probe. And possibly without a subpoena. Mark Zuckerberg testified earlier this year that he was cooperating, that his company was cooperating with the special counsel, and they and senators asked him, have you been given a subpoena? And at first, Mark Zuckerberg says, yes, yes, of course, we've been given a subpoena. And then he's, you know, given a chance to clarify. He says, actually, I'm not aware of any subpoena. So, you know, we, the public, don't know if Facebook received a subpoena, but it's really unsettling and almost seems like a conflict of interest to have one's former client providing information on other people without a subpoena.
Yeah, it just kind of goes to show you what a small world or I guess kind of confusing world it is when you have all this sort of all these interwoven kind of relationships and how they overlap and they often get into law enforcement. But I suppose the overall message here is that things aren't as pure and white and clean as the driven snow as I think a lot of people kind of think of their, you know, the federal law enforcement, that it's really it really has the same kind of qualities that you would expect of Congress and all these other entities in Washington, D.C. with the bureaucracy, right?
Right. That's exactly right. And a lot of people have, I mean, this is the revolving door. A lot of people have, you know, become familiar with the revolving door, and it's even something that people have grown to accept, you know, at the Department of Defense and at the Energy Department. But you really expect the Department of Justice to remain neutral. So when you have these kind of conflicts, you know, justice shouldn't be compromised like this. And, you know, with the politics and bias that everybody's been hearing about for months, when you look at the money, the finances and the politics, it really paints this portrait of corruption, and it's just unsettling, and it really deserves further investigation.
And there you have it. The book is Compromised, How Money and Politics Drive FBI Corruption by Seamus Bruner. Seamus, tell them about where they can learn more about you and about the Government Accountability Institute.
Sure. Well, you can visit the book's website, which is compromisedfbibook.com, and that's got all the videos, and it's actually got some primary source documents. I put all the financial disclosures for these men up there, but those are boring, so read the book instead. And the Government Accountability Institute, you can visit at g-a-i.org, and my personal website is SeamusBruner.com.
All right, well, thanks. Yeah, well, thank you for joining us, and we'll try to get you on again soon. This is Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
And it's Jeff Poore back for you, filling in for Sean Sullivan today on FM Talk 106.5. Let us know what you think. Give us a call, 251-343-0106. Kind of build off the last segment, we were talking about all the things that, you know, go on in the quote-unquote swap. And, you know, obviously James Comey and Robert Mueller aren't immune to it. They're definitely creatures of Washington when we talk about it. Now, I think Comey tried to get out of Washington. If you read his book, he talked about going to New York, moving to Virginia, and how it was Obama who brought him back into D.C. But the point is, you know, this Mueller probe's starting to heat up again a little. I think it's been overshadowed, obviously. Everything has with this hurricane making landfall at the Carolinas. But we had a plea deal with Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's former campaign manager, and Robert Mueller in the probe, and he's pleading guilty to some of the charges. Now, he fought the first charges in the Northern District of Virginia. He had some other charges he had to go face in the courts of D.C., the federal courts of D.C., just because given where the transactions allegedly took place, some took place in Virginia, some took place in D.C. So just by the nature of that, there's two different jurisdictions and they get tried in two different places. So he has the added cost of having to take on two different court proceedings. Well, I think he fought the first one, came unbuck successful, and if you really kind of look at some of the rhetoric coming out of Trump, my guess is maybe Manafort thinks he could play for a pardon from Trump, and that's why, you know, don't read too much into this plea deal right now. These court cases are very expensive to fight. That's the whole goal of the probe, is to flip you as a witness and get you to give the dirt on whoever they're going after. Some people think they're going after Donald Trump. I mean, they probably are. I think that's a safe assumption. They want to see what they could find on the president. That's where these special counsels work. But in any event, they go after the low-hanging fruit, see if they could flip them and get them to testify and put them in front of a jury, and then maybe you have, all of a sudden you have, you know, grounds for impeachment or whatever it may be. In Bill Clinton's case, it was perjury. They ultimately got him on, and the probe started out at the very beginning looking into the Whitewater corruption from his days as Arkansas governor. So you have this cloud hanging over you the whole time. But I think if you're looking at this and you think this is bad news for Donald Trump, it's not necessarily bad news. Donald Trump can pardon these guys anytime he wants. And Manafort's probably sitting there thinking, well, rather than blow an additional few million dollars on a long shot court case, I'm just going to work with the Mueller probe, take the plea, and they can just give me whatever they want. And then maybe later on down the road, Donald Trump will give me a pardon. And he seemed, you know, based on the contrasted tweets of Donald Trump's reaction to Michael Cohen, who also took a plea, and Manafort's conviction, and how Trump spoke highly of Manafort, I kind of wonder if that's not the calculus here. So there's all these things going on, and my advice would be to kind of caution you into reading into that. These are the dark days for Trump, and he's going down, and this is Richard Nixon and all this over again. What I think is really going on is Manafort's just kind of taking the path that's best for him, and he's gaming for the pardon. And then rather than fight a court case you're going to lose anyway, just go ahead, suck it up right now, take the plea deal, and look toward a pardon. This is Jeff Poore filling in for Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.